Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 31, Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, a.k.a. All Day Ray, a.k.a. Errol Flynn. I'm joined here by my benign co-host, former market maker of 20 years and present-day retail trader, a man who earned his stripes on the infamous House Street, breaking hearts and making millions, a man who in his lifetime has taken many losses but is not a loser. I'm talking about Saskatchewan's most eligible bachelor, JJ. How's it going?
Good, brother. How you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. And, you know, I'm ecstatic for our guest today. A man who's been described as one of the most versatile actors on TV. You might know him as Pastor Tim on The Americans, and you definitely know him as Dollar Bill Stern on the Showtime series Billions. But make no mistakes about it, his first love is the theater. Hailing from the great state of Oregon and a rabid Portland Trailblazers fan, I'm talking about Kelly Acoin. Kelly, how's it going?
It's going great. Errol Flynn, huh? I like that. I didn't know I was speaking to Hollywood royalty on this podcast.
Oh, man. I like the history of Hollywood. Interesting character. So, you know, we go with it. So, yeah, great.
Yeah, he's a little a bit of a sort of a rakish guy. yes. If I remember my history correctly,
so. He is absolutely, yes, absolutely. So yeah, you're grateful and honored you joined us, Kelly.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate
it. Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, especially the, you know, this unique time we're in right now. So how's the whole quarantine social distancing lifestyle going for you?
It's a change. It's fascinating. My wife and I have a New York sized apartment, which most of you can probably translate correctly as small. Mm-hmm. Two main rooms that we both are currently in right now. I'm doing this with you guys, and my wife's teaching a class at GEO. All of a sudden had to switch to online in the other room. You know, it's funny. Someone was asking because she's a dancer and a teacher and a historical marine ecologist. So she wears a lot of hats. And when I'm working either on set or on a play, we're often like ships passing in the night. It's hard to find time to actually see each other. And so there was the person who was talking to me earlier was like, so is it a little bit of a silver lining? You actually get to see each other. And I'm like, busier. She in particular is busier than she's ever been. Wow. Because everyone is, you know, everyone's in front of Zoom. I mean, whoever owns Zoom stock has got to be ecstatic right now. You know, she's in front of Zoom setting up the things that she has to actually do. Like, you know, she spent 6 hours, 3 days in a row on a Zoom chat with somebody trying to figure out how to translate their class into an online class. And so now she's doing the class, but that's like pretty much all week. And I mean, it's nuts. It's nuts. And we're going a little stir crazy. We live not too far from Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and we can get out, get some air and still stay away from people and maintain the quarantine. But you know, the circle's getting smaller and so I'm starting off dark, but the circle's getting smaller and smaller. We now have multiple friends who have the virus. Whoa. And then we now know people who have died from the virus. Oh. And there's nothing that brings anything close. I mean, it just brings it all even closer home. And you look out the window and it's like, it's basically a ghost town until you see packs of people jumping on each other and you're like, you're idiots. but anyway, it's a crazy time for everybody. And are you guys in New York?
No, I'm in Florida. He's in Canada. He's in Saskatchewan.
Oh, okay. Well, geez. Yeah. How are you guys doing? I mean, I know Florida, there's no mandated lockdown. How's that going?
I mean, as you probably seen some of the videos, man, like people are definitely not taking it serious, Kelly. I mean, even when I briefly do go outside, maybe to get groceries or something, you know, I'm seeing people congregated at parks playing basketball.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's not helping the cause, man. And I guess people don't really understand the magnitude, you know, of this.
Yeah, and there's so much. I mean, you can stop me. I'm not going to get overtly political, but but there's so many mixed messages, and
right.
And it's just that's the big that will potentially be the biggest killer in my pessimistic mind.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I agree with you. I mean, I think like the flow of information, right? It's like, no one was even prepared for this type of deal. And like the flow of information is just not, it doesn't seem fluid. And in your mind, Kelly, you know, I was going to ask you about this, but I guess while we're on the topic now, like, sure. what do you think, going forward, where do we think we go from here? Or like maybe lessons we take away from this?
Oh, hell, I don't know, man. My dad was in politics. He would be the one, he was a congressman in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And he'd be one of the ones who would have to figure that out from here. I don't know. Just in terms of my business, you know, we've been on hiatus now. Billions has for 2 weeks. And it's we'll see when we get back. You know, we're getting updates, so we don't know right now. But we've shot 7 out of 12 episodes. But you know, my friends, in my community, people who, you know, it's the gig economy. I've got brilliant actor, dancer, writer, you know, theater, live performance friends who did very well for themselves, scratched out careers and really made careers that could sustain them, where they can sustain themselves. And their gigs are all canceled now. And you've got lots of theaters and programming houses that program seasons. You know, they curate seasons. So the 2000 season is gone pretty much now, and they can't just postpone it to next year because they've already programmed 2021. So those shows and that creative energy and those jobs are just gone, and unless they can hold off for maybe 3 years until the next. The next openings are go to a different theater, but everyone's going through the same thing. So, you know, that's the reality for me right now is, the question, I guess, for me right now and for all of us in that economy is, what do we do? When is this going to get back to normal? Will it get back to normal? Will people feel comfortable going back into theaters? And, you know, you hope so. And I believe that people will. I believe people have a fundamental need to gather and hear stories told, whether those stories are movement, dance and words with theater or music. Stories are told in many different ways. So I do think that there's the future in general is not bleak, but the near future certainly is.
Right. So I guess on a lighter note on this topic, how are you? No. I wanted to talk about this anyway, Kelly. No, it's fine. No. So involving this, so how are you doing with no sports, no basketball? It's kind of weird, isn't it?
I know. Yeah, no, it's for sure. It is definitely weird. I'm not a big gambling man, and I've got some buddies who love sports even more than I do, and enjoy the gambling, and exactly. They're going nuts. Yeah. You know, someone's like, there's this video, these great videos of people creating. Little obstacle courses with dominoes. You know, they set up dominoes through the house, and whether or not they can get it all the way to the end. And there was one I just saw recently with a hair blower, a fan, three levels of stairs, and a ping pong ball. And when they made it at the end in this little cup at the bottom of the stairs, the guy was like, "Finally!" And I was like, "Oh, this would be awesome. Set up a thing like that, and then have that guy, whoever it was, or that woman who set up that." Particular obstacle course, take bets each time. You know what I mean? Like somehow hook it up and place odds, and I don't know something to get people into like alternate sports.
Oh, I love it. Oh yeah, Kelly. I mean, I bet on everything, man. Like,
do you?
Yeah. Oh, on every. I mean, that's my background. I was a poker player, now trader.
Sweet. Okay.
Yeah, and No. Some of my buddies are going nuts, and you know, I went over to one of my friends, and he bought an electronic. Horse racing machine, and we was at his house betting on the horses going around the electronic.
Oh my god, track.
That's hilarious! That is hilarious. Yeah, no, but I mean, the biggest thing for me is like I'm a Trailblazer fan, as you said.
Yeah,
and I've gotten I know a couple of the players, and I know a lot of the broadcast team, and I love those guys. And so it's hard for me not to see them. It's you know on League Pass, I always get the the local feed, and I can hear my buddies call the game. And
oh, that's cool.
You know, and so that's hard, and I know that they're hurting. Of course, we were out of the playoffs, so maybe it's a good it's a little bit of a mulligan.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I haven't seen anything, Kelly. Have they made any like announcements about the first, like the rest of the season?
No, but I have heard. Like I was just on Instagram Live with one of the friends I was talking about. Brooke Olsendam was a sideline reporter for the Blazers, and Serena Winters, who's sideline reporter for the 76ers, were doing an Instagram Live thing, and people were asking the questions of what they thought was going to happen. And I guess there are discussions about, you know, obviously we heard maybe playing some games without fans. But I guess there are further discussions about that. And then maybe, you know, things apparently are on the table. We shorten the season to maybe 70 games, or do they, have the playoffs be 5 games each, or do they do like a, I was listening to CJ McCollum on his podcast, and he's like, you know, what do we do? Maybe we do a college style playoff. Mm-hmm. But it has to be shorter no matter what, so that they can still get an off season. Summer right. league's probably out, but they're going to have to get an off season. So yeah, I don't know, but I'm just waiting for the Trailblazer Classic games to come on League Pass so I can relive the last season's playoffs.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
How about you? What are you guys doing? Like, are you missing any sports in particular, or are you like all across the board?
I mean, for me, I'm primarily football. I'm real into football, and I was just seeing, like, even they were talking about some of the owners were saying they're not even sure if they're going to be able to go to training camp or like at least the mini, like the OTAs.
Yeah,
we started in June, but yeah, I mean, I enjoy basketball, just not to the extent of football. I don't know. What about you, Jay?
Oh man, I haven't watched sports in such a long time, ever since I got into this retail trader. I've been in front of these damn charts 18 hours a day, man.
he just references like 1980s football, like that. That's his.
That's
like,
good.
Yeah, I'm still stuck in the 80s. I kind of missed 20 years of life. I was frozen, like Dr. Evil. Yeah.
Oh yeah, totally. The 80s were a good year. That was the last era I really followed football all that much, because Washington. I lived in D.C. at the time, and Washington.
Oh, okay.
Great teams then, you know, Riggins and Theismann, and three different quarterbacks, three different Super Bowls.
Yeah.
Theismann, Rippon, and Doug Williams. Pretty
Doug
amazing.
Williams. Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
Who took over for Jay Schrader like fourth or fifth game of the season, and everyone thought it was lost, and then we won the Super Bowl. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's interesting about football, or interesting to me. I play fantasy football with my buddies, and that has killed my love of the game.
Oh, really?
I don't have any teams anymore. The first time I had a Cowboy player, a Dallas player on my roster, and I rooted for, and I needed him to score a touchdown for me to win the game. And they were playing Washington. First time I realized I was rooting for the Cowboy to score, I was like, well, that's it. My fandom's over.
Yeah.
So it saves me a lot of time. I have my Sundays free.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. No, it's funny. It's like, it like pits you against like your own team. Yeah. I know that feeling. Yeah. That's funny.
That's why I'll never, ever play fantasy basketball, because I've grown up with the Blazers. That's always my dad and I played basketball. He taught me to play basketball. Like, that's my thing.
Yeah.
It would kill me if I ever rooted against the Blazers.
Are you as big as a fan, Kelly, that like when they lose, like it like hurts? Like you're it takes you a little bit to get over it.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Yeah. And the more, you know, the closer to the playoffs, and when it is playoff time, I like, my wife is like, she knows it. She's seen it for years, but every time she sees it again, it's like, oh my God, are you crying? are you okay? It's like, yes, I'm fine. And when Lillard hit that shot from 37 feet, you know, I if you remember, halfway through that quarter, we were down 15. And that was a game where Nurkic came back on the sideline. First time we'd seen him since he'd had that gruesome leg injury at like the 2.5 minute mark. And we were coming back, and it was so emotional. And when he hit that shot, I was jumping up and down. I moved all the coffee table out of the way and everything. I was just jumping up and down. and before the shot, and she was on the couch kind of like hiding. And I just jumped on her, and I was a mess. Like, tears, snot, laughter, you know, like everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's going down in history. That was crazy. That was, yeah.
Was nuts. The wave. And the thing that was so great about that too, so many things were great about that, but Russell Westbrook always has tried to get into Damian Lillard's head.
Right.
Always. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's like rocking the baby every time he scores something. And then Lillard has to sort of say, you don't rock the baby on a 15 footer. That doesn't make any fucking sense. So he's doing it. And then guys who are normally decent guys like Paul George playing with Russell Westbrook all suddenly became a dick. And like, it was like, oh, it's a bad shot. Like, even if you think it was a bad shot, you don't say that. You can't say that at the end. Like, mm-hmm. You got beat. And you beat 4-1. So it wasn't just because of a bad shot, son. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. He's just a bitter at that point. Yeah.
I know. Anyway, yeah. I'm not. So it was nice. They were giving him so much shit. And the one game they won, you know, they were tapping their wrist like Dame does when he hits in Lillard time. And the guy Schroeder was all up in his face and everything. And so they just were such little pricks to him the whole time that when he hit that shot and he waved goodbye, it was just like, yeah. Yeah, y'all deserve that. Because he's a good guy. Like, Lillard, he's not demonstrative in that way. And he's mm-hmm. not a bad sport. He is a gentleman on the court. But treat him like that, and you're going to get some. So, anyway.
Oh, yeah, don't poke the bear. Yeah.
No, don't poke the bear. So, right. You know, not that I'm passionate about that particular game. But
mm-hmm. You grew up playing basketball, Kelly?
I did. I mean, I'm barely 6 feet tall. So I played it. I went to a very small high school in Washington, D.C. So I played all the way through high school. But on the plus side, D.C. is a great, has always been a great basketball town. On the negative side against me, I was a power forward at 5'11 and 3/4. So that shows you how small the team was. It was great. I loved it. Within my niche, I became pretty good, and you know, enough to really love it and be competitive. And I miss it. I played for a long time pickup, but then you get to a certain age, and if you haven't played in 5 years, it's like, oh, I literally can't move laterally anymore.
He said literally.
I said literally laterally.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can still shoot. I just can't. I can't really play. If that makes any sense.
The movement, the movement's not there. So when you were in high school, Kelly, were you into acting? Was that something you knew you wanted to? Yeah.
I wanted to be an actor from when I was like probably in junior high, but I didn't tell anybody till I think maybe sophomore or junior year of high school. And weirdly, the guy who I told was my biology teacher, who was into theater. We went to a school where, it was a small school, but there were a couple drama people and some music people. And the biology guy was actually a former actor, and he sang and he directed a couple one acts and things like that that students were in. And he was the one who had the most connections with people who had made careers. Excuse me. They made careers as actors in New York. And so when I first told him, I always expected people to be like, oh yeah, sweet little stupid kid. And he was supportive, and he was the first guy who actually said the words, I think you can make it. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot. Yeah. So, awesome. And he gave me the confidence to tell my parents. And, I think I lucked out in a way, my dad being a congressman. The one thing he never, the careers are different, although there's both in the public eye, I guess, on stage some certain amount of the time. Mm-hmm. But he also had no job security. Every 2 years he could be voted out of office. Oh. So I think that made it slightly easier for him to think of me getting into a field that, you know, mm-hmm. that had no security.
Right, right. Yeah, no, definitely can relate to that. Like, it's only like coming from a gambling background. It's like, you know, you don't have security neither.
Trading either.
Yeah, right, that too.
Exactly. Yeah. So go ahead.
Well, no, I was just gonna say, yeah, there's some similarities, and when you have a great performance, you know, there are huge rewards that people who don't risk as much,
right.
Will never feel or get or receive, and you know, if I've never felt more alive than being on stage during a scene or a moment or a stretch of 3 minutes where everything just more than full plays, just like stretches that are just gloriously perfect, and not perfect in that there were no mistakes, just like the mistakes didn't matter. Mistakes mm-hmm. didn't come into it. It was just like you're in its flow, that just thing,
right,
that
flow state.
Elusive mm-hmm. things. Yeah, yeah. Flow state.
Yeah,
and right there's place. Nothing like that in the world. And yeah,
definitely.
And you know, people don't get into people who don't risk don't really get to feel that, exactly. I don't think.
Yeah. He who dares, my son, he who dares.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, well said.
And a lot of people, you know, then there are downsides. There could be a fucking virus and it destroys your industry. So you never get to act again. But you know, whatever. Yeah. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. So how was your early career, Kelly? You know, I imagine you know, or at least I hear acting, it's hard to like get in, to break in. Mm-hmm. Like, did you hold other jobs at first? Did you get in right away?
Yeah.
What was it like?
Oh yeah. No, I was the proverbial tortoise. After I left college, I did not go to grad school, which, so I've never been in that sort of financial hole, which is good, but I probably lost a few years, you know, the connections made from grad school, the grad school process. I didn't have that. I drove around the country, in a Volkswagen bus after college, sleeping in parking lots of some of the best hotels in the country. but, you know, and ostensibly I was supposed to be dropping off my resume at different theaters around the country. And I did a few, but I ran out of money in Portland, Oregon, which is fortunately where my parents had a little one bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. And my dad was back and forth, but I crashed there while I worked in a steel mill to make money to get back.
Really?
And while I was there for a month and a half, yeah, I saw some audition notices, and I auditioned for this one play in particular. I got in, and I promised I would be back. This was summer. I promised I would be back for rehearsals right after Thanksgiving, and I did. I came back. Flipped my car on the way over because I hit a patch of black ice. But this is an epic story. It sounds like I'm bullshitting. But it sort of went sideways and hit the median of the freeway that had about a foot and a half of snow. So it went down, and buses, you know, VW buses are light.
Yeah.
So it came down really soft, and some guys in a 4x4 came and pulled me back over, and I was fine. Nothing, you know, very little damage.
Wow.
Anyway, so I did the play, and that was my first. And then I did the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is a big thing in regional theaters. And that's when I thought, oh, I've made it. I have made it. And I'm going to go down to L.A. because that's where my girlfriend was. And I could not get arrested. And I did one play in 2 years or a year and a half. And what saved me and eventually my career was that she, as a dancer, wanted to challenge herself against the best and decided she was going to move to New York, and mm-hmm. I followed. And even then, it took me forever to get anything that paid, maybe 5 years. But it still was the right place for me. I was still getting better and learning and getting I guess I had little tiny paying things, but nothing substantial. It was after 8, 9, 10 years that I started really getting the types of gigs that led to the types of things I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what like kept you going through? And I think this could be related to like anyone in any type of profession, right, Kelly? Mm-hmm. Like, cause a lot of times people think like, oh, right away, like you're going to, if I'm good at something, I'm going to be good at it right away. And a lot of times it's like you said, mm-hmm. and like, I know I've read books on it, like 8 to 10 years, right. The 10,000 hours, et cetera, whatever it is.
Yeah.
But what kept you going? Like, you know, it took to take you that long.
I think there were a number of things. We had, financially speaking, our situation in New York was extraordinary. Mother of a friend from college, owned a brownstone outright since like 1970. And she rented out the top floor to people. And she gave it to us for a ludicrously low amount of money. Didn't need the money. She just wanted the company, you know? Mm-hmm. And we were there for a long time, so we didn't have much overhead. So I could do like, I could be an extra or do stand-in work a couple days a week. And then Carolyn could get something coming in at the coffee shop she worked at or something. Or I could do a catering gig. And we would have our nut in like 3 days, maybe four.
Oh, nice.
So that made things easier. It was like she was a patron of the arts in a way. She didn't give us money, but she charged us very little. Yeah. So that helped. The other thing is, I always had a sort of had a weird dual way of thinking about myself and my talent. I was always nervous that I wouldn't make it. I was always nervous, like most artists are, that I would be discovered as a fraud at any moment. But I also weirdly thought, no, I'm good. It's weird. It's hard to explain that dichotomy. And there were enough people who, along the way, who at very strategic times, who people I respected, who would say, "You're good. You're really good. You need it, it just," and they never had any advice about how to go about getting those gigs finally. But it was just because I wasn't hurting financially. I was just sort of, my nature is a little bit more romantic too. So I had this romantic sense of, no, we're going to make it. It's fine. Whatever's this is fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was buoyed by those people saying, you have it, whatever that is. And then finally just a couple breaks, you know, a couple doors went down, and then TV wise, it was a house of cards that started to put me on people's radar.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I had some of those people I was talking about who said, "Yeah, you kid." And then increasingly they stopped saying kid, but that's just what happens. A number of those people were casting directors in town. Okay. And especially the independent casting directors, the younger ones who had maybe seen me when they were working for other more early established casting people, and went off on their own, and they would get a show, and they would keep me bringing me back to audition for that show. Suzanne Ryan for Law and Order, she's been working with the Law and Order franchise forever. She brought me in all the time, and her response to me, even when I didn't get the gig, was always heartening. And then a lot of these younger ones coming up who just kept trying to not force me on people, but just try to find me the right fit. And I would get enough feedback saying like, no, the producers loved you. It's just not the fit they want. That I thought, okay, that means that I really could have gotten this gig. There's nothing that I'm not inherently stupid to try this out. I'm not being delusional. It's just a run of bad luck or
the right part. Yeah.
Or the right part. And then, you know, there were a couple times disheartening things where I'd get a major callback, and I used to think I was a terrible auditioner. I actually was fine. But I got to the point where I could really do callbacks well. And then when I would get these in the midst of this period I'm talking about, when I would get a great callback, because the first audition went so great, I blew a couple and I knew it. And that was the type of thing that made me, those were the hardest things to deal with, actually. Where you blew a really good chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I lived in Vancouver 26 years. A lot of my buddies are actors and casting directors and stuff like that. So I know what they go through. I was like, wow, man, you've got to be mentally tough to, you know, withstand the rejection. You know?
Yeah, and it's tough for casting directors too. I mean, getting to know, I'm friends with a number of them now, and you never really think of it that way. They they're scrambling too, and if they're not working for a network, then they're scrambling to get enough jobs. Exactly. Just the right balance. Like, I need two gigs. If I do three, it'll be more money, but then I can't really do my job very well or something, you know.
Yeah,
but definitely. Vancouver's a great town for TV.
And, yeah. They, I was there through the whole X-Files
thing. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of those shows that I still regret not being on. Like, if I were...
Oh, you would have been great on that show.
I would have... Oh, God. I was a Northwest.
You would have killed that.
Come on.
You would have killed it. Yeah.
Two of the shows I really regret not being on, or three actually, one's going to really date me, but the X-Files, West Wing, because of my dad's experience. Mm-hmm. I love that show. And then Saint Elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Did you watch that?
Of course. I love that show because my parents wanted me to be a doctor. I had no talent. Yeah.
Okay, do you remember, did you ever watch The White Shadow?
Yes. Okay, the White Shadow.
With that, it was like the guy who played Salami.
Yeah.
Had a different role.
Oh.
One of the characters, the guy who played the center on the Carver High School team, played himself as an orderly at the hospital.
That's
that was
right.
The same name and everything. And when the guy who played Salami was playing a different character, got into the elevator, he passed by him, and the guy says, Salami! And and the actor's like, no, you got the wrong man, dude. Such a great little meta moment.
Oh, yeah. I just, this little The White Shadow, love that show.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
Yeah, you know, Kelly, listening to you, you know, talking about that, like acting in a sense, right? Like you have to probably be okay with rejection, or I'm sure you're in time you got okay with rejection. And it's like similar to trading, right? Like we're going to lose, we're going to have losing trades, and we got to bounce back from it. So maybe what were some of like the methods, or how did you handle rejection?
That's a good question. I mean, my ability to successfully do that waxes and wanes, definitely. I remember one of the first big break I was going to get TV wise. I was on hold for like 3 weeks, and then my wife and I went off on a Christmas vacation, and first day, I think when we got off the airport, we got our car and we were driving to where we were going to stay, and a phone call comes in from my manager, and my wife has to take it, because I'm driving. And she's like, hey, what's the news? Because we knew this was about the time it was coming. And then I heard a pause, and I heard my wife's voice go, I think you need to talk to Kelly. And I was like, oh, fuck. So we pulled over, and she told me. And that was – I had one day where I was just – I couldn't be cheered up. But then it was fine. You know, it's – I don't know. I don't know what the method is. That case, it was – we're getting our first Christmas alone without family, without friends, just the two of us. And I don't want to ruin the vacation. So you know, there's that sort of that theory that you make yourself happy, you make yourself laugh until, and it's fake for a while. And then all of a sudden you are laughing.
Yeah.
It's actual laughter. And I, you know, that can work sometimes and not other times, but it worked in this case. I don't know. It depends. If it's in the middle of a good spell, then it doesn't hurt as much. If it's cumulative, and it's the 10th in a row, 50th in a row, 100th in a row, then it gets that could get you down, especially if you don't have another gig. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's been 8 years now, I think, that I've had some version of security in the recurring role on The Americans and then being a series regular on Billions. I know that even if I screw up everything else, I'm going to have this for a while. Yeah. You know, and we're in season 5 now, and who knows how many more seasons that'll last, but it is amazing how much easier it is to go into an audition when you know that they know your work already.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that they know you. And I get some offers now, which is nice. That helps without auditioning. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Well, what about you guys? Like, is there, has this changed for you? Like, okay. And is it different? Is poker or any sort of gambling different than trading in terms of those whatever mechanisms you might have?
In my opinion, no. Cause you know, and a lot of people, and this is my opinion, like a lot of people, cause trading has more of a, what's like a correct, like an acceptable lens in society, right? So
right,
a lot of people don't even view it as gambling, but it really is. I'm betting whether I think it's going to go up or down.
Right.
And so the mentality of like handling losses, in my opinion, is the same. And I don't know, Kelly, it's a tough thing as well. I mean, I guess I think the only thing for me that's always kept me going is just the passion for it. You know, like I can't see myself doing anything else, honestly.
Yeah, definitely. And for me, I come from the institutional side of trading, and now I'm a retail trader. But on the institutional side, it's not gambling at all, because we're the ones who are actually moving the market. And, you know, like, you know, as you as a PM on the show, portfolio manager, you guys are the ones who are moving the market. So I came from that side to this side, which is, you know, it was quite a change, but I still love the game. Yeah.
That's a key thing that I didn't mention. You're right. It's like the really literally not being able to see myself doing anything else or see yourself do anything else. That is that'll get you through a lot of down times. It would take a lot to get me to start looking elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You know,
Definitely.
I can't even imagine what that would be. Speaking of what it's funny. I was just sort of chuckling because you said, because you referenced me as a PM, and I was like, who's he talking to? He's talking about, oh, me on the show. Right. Because you will never find, I don't think you're going to find another actor who knows less about finance than the one you're talking to on the phone right now. It's crazy.
You nail the part to the T. You remind me of all my buddies back in the day. And that's exactly what we were like, you know, and I'm going to get into it. I'll let Ray finish. But I mean, I love that show because it reminds me of home.
Oh, that's awesome. That's nice. Yeah. I've never heard anyone say it that way before. That's nice. That's great.
Yeah. It's just well done all around. I mean, Brian and David, they know what they're doing. And Rounder, I love them from Rounders. Like, one of my favorite movies.
Amazing.
So many just finally great getting quotables.
Finally getting its due too. I mean, maybe that's because of the success of Billions, but I always thought for a long time, I thought it was a really under the radar classic. People who knew movies and gambling loved it, but not everyone necessarily knew it.
Oh, yeah. And the acting talent in that.
You know, come on.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Ridiculous.
Such a great script too.
Yeah.
No, I love working. But that's the thing. Like these guys and the writer's room, they create such vivid, specific characters and scenarios and dialogue that I know what I'm doing in the moment. And they've had people on who are sort of dramaturgs, you know, who will work with the actors so that if there's a question, if we don't really know what we're talking about, there's someone we can call and ask. We can also do that with Brian and David. They're great. And they're like, no, any question, I don't care if it's, don't feel stupid if it's tiny, just, and that's, that goes with trading, that goes with, any of our pop culture references, and any sports references, anything. You know what you're doing, what you're talking about in the moment. But I swear, after I wake up the next morning, I'm like, now tell me what supply side is again.
You know, I am telling you, a dollar bill. I mean, and I'm going to go into billions right now for a little
bit. Go ahead.
Because here's the thing. I grew up on the desks trading on the phone, like that episode when you guys lost the phones.
Brought
out the burners. I was like, oh yeah, I'm home. You know, give me three phones. Let's go, baby. And you brought out the Filofax, you know, and oh yeah, there's some beautiful women. And then somebody said, yeah, and they're grandmothers now. Well, that's, that's Ray with me now in the trading room because I'm the old guy. Right.
So
the beautiful women they actually are grandmothers. So, you know, it's, and I love that show because you are exactly like cut from the cloth. I don't know who wrote that character, but there are bits of that character that I have friends that I could introduce you to, and you would see dollar bill, like the cheapest guy, $10 million, and he takes $2,000 out for his out of the fund. I've got guys like that. You know, I had one of my mentors was worth about $30 million, and he drove a 79 Cadillac Eldorado.
I love that.
You know,
love that.
And every time he would just get it redone every like couple of years,
right.
You know,
I mean, they wrote these characters. There's nothing that we do on the show, dialogue wise, that is unscripted. There's no, improv, there's nothing, but you know, obviously we take this and we, with their guidance, if we are off base, but we do what we do, which is interpret and bring character out. But the writing is so crisp and so I mean, brilliant to me, that it gives you all early on, in particular, when we really were looking for clues to who these characters were, yeah. It gave you everything you needed. I mean, I only had what, a handful of lines in the pilot, but the description, you know, and the nickname Dollar Bill, and he's the cheapest millionaire. And
oh yeah.
Cheapest millionaire.
Sort of, yeah. And I'm sort of stabbing my friend, the Pouch. Remember that character?
Oh, Pouch was great.
Back a little bit. Yeah. It's like, oh, there's so much. I've said this before. I actually turned the audition for this character down.
Yeah,
I auditioned for another bigger character. I turned it down because I thought, it doesn't even say recurring character, and it's only a few lines. I don't think so. And over the weekend, read the description again, thought about it, read the script, noticed the people who were involved in the project, and I was I think I need to get in. So.
Well, yeah, my favorite characters are Dollar Bill's number one, and then Wags, right?
Of course.
Oh, I mean, because I had a Wags. You know, we had a Dollar Bill, we had a Wags, and then and then Hall. I love Hall.
Oh yeah.
Because my clients were like Hall.
I had a lot of
those were my clients.
That's interesting. So you had clients that you didn't know if you turned your back they'd kill you.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I treaded in the other under $20 world. So my clients made the Wolf of Wall Street look like the Lamb of Wall Street. you know, they Lex Luthor looked like Mary Poppins. That's how they were.
Wow.
Yeah, like some of them were ex-spooks. You know, guys like that Grigor guy. I had guys like that. I've got some pretty crazy stories, but it's just, you know, you hit that so well. And then with Spiros, the compliance officer, when you rammed his Porsche with your minivan, I was just, every trader around the world just stood up and cheered when you did that. Right. You know, we just were like, oh, we love Dollar Bill. Right.
Like, because fuck compliance.
That was our fantasy every day.
Right.
Right. And see, we had a compliance offer that we could bribe. We would run trades in his sister's account.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
You know, so we
That's
had
brilliant.
That. Yeah. That
That's was, brilliant.
Yeah. So, it was just beautiful, you know, and
that was one of the most cathartic things I've ever done.
Oh.
Not only as an actor, but as a human person. Just because I got to do the actual smashing of the car. The stunt people did the first one, which was a long drive from, like, you know, 100 feet away or whatever we were. And then I got to do I got to smash a freaking Porsche 25 times. And it was just, Steve Kunkin, who plays Spiros, and I bonded so deeply that episode because it was just so much rage on both characters' part, you know, so much energy. And even like when I was doing the fuck you know, he got behind the car and he was like goading me so he would get more out of me, you know, off camera.
He nails compliance to the core, you know. He just nails that part. Like, there's so much talent on that show.
I think he might be a comic genius. He's great. I love having scenes with him. I love the sort of odd couple dynamic that Dollar Bill and Spiros have. It's a great group. I say this all the time too, but honestly, for a show that's so much about human toxicity, it is about, and in some ways just terrible people. It's just a group of lovely, lovely people.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
like the cast and the crew, it's his family. I was there the last night for the last shot that we did before we took the hiatus. And it was amazing, the love around the room of just everybody, you know, be safe. If you need anything, let's stay and, you know, let's make sure we keep talking to everybody. And it's really, it's a great place to go to work.
Well, like the other thing that you nail and you've never
I like
even
hearing
worked.
That stuff.
No, I'm telling you, is the loyalty factor to acts, right?
Oh yeah.
See, on my business card, it used to say your secrets will die with me, right? So, I get that right away, right? You know, Dollar Bill would take a bullet for acts. Like when he takes off his pants, you know.
Yeah. like, okay, put your pants on.
Oh my God! Yeah, you know.
Yeah, the idea. I was talking to Brian and David about, like, so why does he? Like, why is he doing, I mean, let's get into this a little bit more. I mean, I knew ostensibly why, but just the idea that, and he misinterprets what Axe says.
Yeah.
He thinks Axe is saying you're wearing a wire.
Yeah.
And which isn't what he says at all. But he's like, that I can't, that's, yeah. insane.
Oh, yeah. Here. Like, I would let never me, do that to you. You know?
Yeah. So let me yeah. show you on the street. Yeah. And it's yeah. just like, so it, yeah, they're very good. And Dollar Bill's a secondary character. So there's not, you know, there aren't tons of major story arcs for him. But when they do have them, they're so crisply and finely drawn that there's so much to sink your teeth into.
And the chicken, you know, the chicken episode. Oh, my God. So. Because I have done things to protect the profit. And so I totally get the motivation, right. you know. And that was right. just, you know. And then, of course, the Jack Nicholson Chinatown reference at the end. Oh, that was just nailed it.
Do you know how hard we worked to get the, like, even if you look side by side, the way I turned back around and the way yes. Wags and the way
yes.
Damien, like, touched my shoulder and all that. We tried to get the timing down exactly the way they did it in the yeah. movie. And we got pretty damn close, actually.
No, I mean, anyone who's ever sat on a trade desk or worked in situations like that, there's so many parts of that character. And it's amazing that you would think that you've never actually worked or even probably stepped foot on a trading floor before this.
I have, actually. We've been on I've been to the stock exchange 3 times now.
Okay.
So I met a bunch of people and we rang the bell and that was fun. But no, I've never traded. I get brain freeze when I'm trying to do my own taxes, you know. but again, we have good people, great writing, great actors, but mainly the writing and the directors who really make sure we know exactly what we're talking about in the moment.
Oh,
and
yeah.
we do our research, of course. But
and there was one thing that you got, and this really got me. This was like, this shows that there's somebody who really knows their stuff on that show. When the phones went down and you said, I got a buddy in Toronto we can do some selling through.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Because I used to be that guy for the U.S. traders, right?
That's cool.
And we used to call that a jitney, right? Where you'd yeah. sell through somebody else so they didn't know where it was coming from. So I was the guy who did that for people. And so I was like, wow, somebody really hit the nail on the head with this. You know?
Oh, that's great. So you yeah. were my guy.
I yeah.
that's awesome. Yeah.
Well, so in preparation for the role, Kelly, you know, we spoke a little bit before we got on here about like Tourney Duff. You, to get inside the heads of these guys, because you said not knowing nothing about finance, these were the type you talked to? Like what type of research did you do yourself?
I didn't. I honestly didn't do a ton of research before the role started.
Went to scores.
It was so specifically written, like what I was supposed to do, what was in my head, and what I meant, what the character was doing in the moment was so completely obvious on the page. But then, yeah, I did. I meeting Tourney and reading his book was great. And I remember one time Tourney saying something like I did a take, and he's like, Kelly, do you know what you just said? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, no, you don't. No, you don't. Come here. And so, you know, you get some of that. And also, obviously, the guys are going to be, Brian and David are going to be making sure you know. I mean, and they expect you to know what the references yeah. are when you come in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your own research combined with asking questions before you get to set. One of the things I really appreciate about this set is that everybody, we know our lines. I've been on lots of sets where, you know, a take will go like, so I think you really need line.
Okay. Oh.
So I think you really need to get on the line, and it goes on like that. And it's just sort of, granted, a lot of times it's a New York show and they're writing the scripts in LA. And so they get them in the morning when they wake up on some of the last changes. But still, this is a show where everyone shows up, not only off book, but enough off book and having thought about the scenes enough that they can play, and you can get multiple different takes and multiple ways of doing it. And so it doesn't waste time. And that's when magic can happen as an actor. You can't be like, you can often tell when an actor, you can see behind his eyes, his or her eyes, there's something sort of, glassy. It probably means they're searching for lines. But if you're really into it, if you know those, then you're free to play. Then you're free to react differently and not think, you know, you fully can think, what do you mean by that or whatever? And that was my best acting ever. but as opposed to what the fuck is my next line? you know.
Yeah.
And they want, there's no paraphrasing on this show. Like I said, there's no improv and there's no paraphrasing. They want you word perfect. And it's such good writing. Like
it is.
There's nothing I could do to make it better. So I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna memorize my fucking lines, you know.
Yeah. And you could see the clues of Turney in some of the stuff there, you know. Like the short squeeze one, right?
I don't know if Turney had anything to do with writing the scripts, but
that's a good, that's from right out of his book with the telecom.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's
you
awesome.
Know, and the Admiral Fund, right? That's straight out of his book too. Turney and I met in 98.
Okay.
In Scores. with a bunch of sales traders from Knight. That's how I know him. And that's why he's been on the show. Love that.
Oh, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. And honestly, if I can plug my buddy, our buddy, anyone out there listening should read The Buy Side. It's a great memoir. That's really gripping. I don't read a lot of nonfiction but it cooks. The story's great. Oh, and there's a lot of suspense to it.
It really is.
And yeah, so.
I'm surprised, like even for someone who, I mean, he was a trader, background as a trader, you know, just the way he wrote the book. I just thought it was real impressive from that standpoint.
Yeah. And it's honest too. He really bears his soul, you know.
He never lets himself off the hook either.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's like, it's fascinating. It's a brave piece of writing, exposing himself and what happened and how he was, how much of it he was responsible for himself. Mm-hmm. But you also, his heart and his great soul, not to get spiritual, but he's a great soul.
And
that comes through in every moment. So you're always rooting for him.
Mm-hmm. Love the Duff.
Yeah. And he works on scripts all the time, and we've talked he's told me some of his ideas and I've read some of his other pieces, and he's a great writer. He's great. I can't wait to do a movie with him or something, you know?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, yeah. It was absolute. He was super nice, Jay, when he came on. We had a lot of fun.
Right.
Yeah. Looking forward to, you know, getting him back on here. You know, Kelly, so, you know, everybody, like everyone is just loves Brian and David. I don't ever hear anyone say anything bad about them. Obviously they're great writers, but I guess they're solid guys too, huh?
They're fantastic. They're funny as hell. It's great being around them because they are, you know, they've been best friends since I think 14, 12, something like that.
Wow,
since they were young teenagers at the latest. And so that's infectious. And it's interesting to be around two guys who, the personalities aren't exactly the same by any stretch, but they're complementary. Like you get the sense, or I often get the sense that they probably have a shorthand, you know, they probably don't even need to speak in complete sentences and they'll know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems seamless. And, they're great. I love my bosses. Very lucky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like what he's been doing on Twitter with the, what do you call it? The Royale,
the
cup of coffee in the morning. I see you've been participating in that.
Yeah. It was a great idea. Yeah, we're all stuck separate. Let's be alone together. And let's take a picture of yourself with your first cup of coffee. I never knew first cup of coffee was called the Royale. I don't. Neither did he coin that?
Did he just make that up? I think he just made it up, right?
He so easily could have made it up because his brain comes up with awesome things. But or it's like it's something that, like, when I'm around him and like, I don't know, like some of the other guys on set, it's like, wow, I'm sort of less of a man than I really should be. Like, I don't gamble, right? I haven't really been into boxing.
That was a great episode.
Yeah. And I met Deontay Wilder on that. So I became a huge Deontay Wilder fan. But I like, and so I was like, oh, great. The Royale is just another cool thing that the George Clooney and Brad Pitt of my show knew. And I did. Wonderful. I'm Matt Damon. So I'd be curious to know.
That's funny. All right. So I just got some kind of like general acting questions, Kelly. So how often are you pleased with yourself? Like, do you know, like, immediately? Like when you're done with the scene, do you know if you like killed it or not, or you're not, you're unsure until you actually watch it?
My immediate answer is no, I don't. But it's a mix. It's that same thing. It's a version of that same thing I was describing from earlier in the career and why I didn't quit. Mm-hmm. Like there's an uncomfortable feeling that, and this happens in every play process I'm into. Okay, this is the one where I get exposed. This is the one where they realize that I am I'm a fraud, and I'll never act again. But at the same time, there has to be a level of, I don't think it doesn't have to be cockiness, although that could work for some people, but of confidence that allows you to be audacious in the moment and okay. and not in any way apologize for it. And by apology, I don't mean verbally, I just mean in your actions. I mean, you could see somebody, whether it's an acting student or an actor or just someone in conversation, who's sort of back-footed about things and sort of their breathing is not quite, you know, they're not quite grounded. And that is often what I call apologetic acting. And you just have to find a way to be audacious and in the moment say, fuck it. I am the best actor, the best actor you're ever going to see. And then you can sort of, it's the same thing as, you know, laughing, fake laughing until it's real. You can convince yourself of that in the moment, and not in a competitive way. I don't really mean it that way, but, in a way that is exhilarating. And then you feel you sometimes find flow. You sometimes find stuff that's just good enough, but you find the thing that makes it work. This is why my rambling answer now is why I've never been a particularly good teacher, acting teacher, because I don't know how to describe it particularly well.
There's some things I don't think can be explained with words, though, at the same time, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, I didn't, possibly because I didn't go to grad school. There's a lot of language I'm vaguely familiar with it, but it's not how I prepare a character.
Yeah.
And so for me, oftentimes when you talk about it too much, you kill it. That spark is, as soon as you name it, then you're trying to come at it in a different way that is more maybe result oriented but it's not alive. It's now intellectual as opposed to something that's in your bones. And that for me, different for other actors, I'm sure, but for me, that kills it. And then I become it becomes an intellectual exercise. Sometimes it's even as silly as, oh, I've told them what I'm trying to do now, and now they're judging. Oh, that's what you thought that was? You know, it's kind of like if you're flirting with somebody and having them be like, oh, is that your sexy face? Oh, great. You know, it's a weird dynamic. It's a very delicate thing. I know that sounds silly, but it is. It's a delicate thing to make something. And it has to be, you have to find the magic in it. And other people approach it differently, but that's me.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of like, Jay, like I think like equating it to like trading, right? It's like we talk about, we make like football analogies, right? Like if we're going to make a mistake, right? Or if we're worried about a mistake, we're going to make it full speed.
Yeah. You gotta run it up the middle, you know? Sometimes you just... especially in your craft, I think, because it is a craft. And I think, like, you know, just because I'm just blown away at how accurate Dollar Bill is and how you play him, because it just honestly, it takes me back to 1997. Right.
I love that. And
it's just, you know, and I feel like I'm there. And that, for a guy who was on a desk, I miss that more than air itself. and you bring that home, right? Which is, and you know, the other characters, because we didn't have quants, like we didn't have the tailors and all that sort of stuff. So it was mostly guys like Dollar Bill and Pouch. And you just, and I think, I don't know if you actually sat next to like traders and observed them for periods of time but no. You just nailed it. See, and you didn't even have to do that. That is pure talent.
Right. Oh, thanks, man. I do appreciate that. I mean, I did meet, they'd bring some guys on set.
Yeah.
And you get to meet and talk to some people, but I didn't have access at the time to sit on the floor or something. It would have been fun to do. I actually, I've had a couple people say, if you want to follow around, please do. And so I actually may take people up on that. But no, it means, that means a lot. I mean, you could probably imagine, like, you're in the field.
Yeah.
You were in that business. And,
And
so, and if it's resonating, that's great.
And it was the best time of my life. Never made so much money. Never had so much fun. I mean, every day was like Animal House. And and I loved every second of it. And so when I watch that show, it just, it just makes you feel good. You know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I love that. Cool.
Yeah, that is. That is. So Kelly, how much, I guess kind of while we're talking about this, how much do you think is acting is innate talent versus work ethic?
That's always the question, isn't it? I mean, I think, and I could change my mind tomorrow, but I think it's both. Certainly it's both. Mm-hmm. So it makes it easier if you have innate talent, but you have to work at it if you want to have a sustained career. I think that's why so many brilliant, even movie stars, have strong theater backgrounds. You know, the ones who really, not necessarily the ones who become working actor movies, regular movie people, you know what I mean? Like the Richard Jenkins or of course now I'm blanking on names. You're going to have certain people who will make it just because they're gorgeous and there's some chemistry they have with the audience. But they're a handful of those people. The ones who actually make it and have interesting careers and play interesting roles are often people who had theater backgrounds. And those people inherently have to work at it to make careers. Right. That said, what innate talent actually is can be a sort of mercurial thing, right? Someone looks at some actor who just doesn't do it for them and they think they're bad. How many stories have we heard of some of brilliant people who are like, I think Steve Buscemi, maybe, I'm probably making that up, but Steve Buscemi, I think, said someone told him that, you know, you'll be an actor when hell freezes over. So somebody like that, someone with like a really good solid career who's like, oh, he's fantastic. But oftentimes maybe it's because he's really quirky or she's really not quite the normal type, and and people without much creativity of their own pigeonhole them as mediocre talents when in fact it's just different. And I mean, it's one of the reasons why I was glad I didn't go to grad school. I didn't do well in classes. I learned a lot more easily working with other actors and with directors. And this grad school always seemed to me to be a place where they tried to teach you to act a certain way. I think I was wrong about that, knowing other actors who've gone through. But certainly there are people who try to do that to you, and they're not going to be able to see innate talent necessarily. And so, you know, someone who someone thought was who had no talent might actually be a brilliant actor if they were just given a chance. And so it's hard. It's hard to know. It's not a science.
Right.
But
interesting. So Kelly, so you kind of you came up through the theater, correct?
Yeah.
Now for people who, I guess, like really respect the art of acting, isn't theater kind of considered a little bit more of a, what's the word, like a harder
craft?
A harder craft, correct? Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I think you have snobs everywhere. Of course, you're going to have some theater actors who are like, who think that's the only real acting, but they're both hard in their own ways. It took me a while to figure out what the difference was. Like my early, if I look at some of the early stuff I did on TV or indie movies or something, I could never figure out why I just was like, yeah, it's serviceable. But I knew I could really kick ass, nail it on stage, and I didn't know why I couldn't translate that. Part of it is that there's no rehearsal, you know. It's great to have take after take after take, but it just can't replace 3 weeks to 3 to 5 weeks of rehearsal, where you know it's like you jump out of a plane. You know, like, you know what you're doing. It's a free fall, but you know.
Okay.
You know where you're going. But I grew, so for a long time I thought, ironically, that screen acting was harder. Now that I'm doing both of them more equally, I think they just have their different, challenges. And it's fun to go back and forth. And there's so many theater, TV coming en masse to New York, I think is one of the best things that happened to both theater and TV. Like so many of the shows that I think are the best acted are shooting here, or in other theater towns, you know, like Chicago or London. There's great stuff coming out of London. And that's because there's this, there was just this group of actors that was a largely untapped well of actors from the theater who now could be fresh faces on TV shows. And there were just more TV shows everywhere. There's more content.
Yeah.
And conversely, the money that came in could sustain theater actors so that they could continue their theater habit. Most of those shows shot, you know, if you were a regular, it was only 6 months out of the year because it was a 10 to 13 show episode model as opposed to 20 or 18, you know, on the network model. So you could then sustain a theater career as well. I'm generally able to do like a play a year, which is awesome. So anyway, that's a convoluted non-answer, I think. But yeah, and I love them both. I would have said, I think theater will always be it's my first love, and it's always going to be special in that way. But because I've had a chance to with the Americans somewhat and Billions more, work so many episodes, the backstory of the episodes that we've shot already sort of take the place of a lot of rehearsal. So you don't have to rediscover the character from scratch. You just have to rediscover. You have to discover what's happening in this moment. So there's an equivalency now in terms of my love and appreciation.
Okay, interesting. So with the actors that you've worked over the years, do you have? I'm sure, obviously, like yourself, right? You can tell you're passionate about the craft of it. How many actors are there that are maybe in for more of like superficial reasons?
Oh God, I don't know. I fortunately haven't had to work with many of them, so
okay.
It's hard to know. I mean, and it's also, I get hesitant to judge because there could be people who present in a way that's more cavalier. Maybe that's just their defense. Maybe that's just how they feel comfortable in a room. But I mean, all I want is people who will play ball, to use a sports metaphor.
Yeah.
I want to come in, and this sort of answers the question you asked before about something along the lines of essentially, like, if you're not feeling it, like, I guess you were saying, do you nail it? So whatever, I'll answer a different question that you didn't ask. But, you know, a way, if you're not feeling it, to actually get a good performance out of yourself is to play ball with your scene partner. Their energy is going to help you pull something out. Like in acting, best acting is listening. And it's really hard to just really listen. If you've done the take 15 times and it's really late, you've been on the set for 16 hours, to really listen for that 15th take, although we don't get that many takes on TV, but still, to really listen, and even though you know exactly what the person's saying, is sort of a paradox. But that's how you get a good scene that's kinetic, that's magic. And those are the actors that I've worked with people who I thought, I'm really not going to like this person. This person is just, this is a shit show. And then you get to act with them in a scene, and it's like, oh no, you care. And you're focused with me. You're connected with me. You are being a generous actor. You're playing ball. And that's all I care about. That's all I care about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. All right. Just a few more miscellaneous things, Kelly.
Sure.
And we'll wrap this up. I saw that you appeared on The Sopranos. So you know, what was that experience like? And then also, what's your take on the ending? Obviously, you know, that was a controversial thing.
The ending?
Yeah.
Okay. So first of all, I had not seen The Sopranos except a handful of episodes until earlier this year. I started watching, and I tweeted that I was going to start, and my boss Brian Koppelman was like, "Wait, really? Wait, wait, what? and I tweeted back like, I'm fired, aren't I? And he's like, kind of.
Kind of.
Yeah. So I'm only through the episode where he takes his daughter to the college, to visit the college.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I do know about the ending though. Yeah. And I've seen the scene because you can't miss it. It's been, yeah, what, 10 years now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. More?
Yeah, more. Yeah.
Wow.
It strikes me as brilliant, but I don't feel like I really have a leg to stand on in the argument.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
But I think it sounds brilliant. So I don't know if you saw the episode, the one I did, I had one line. It was pouring down rain, fake rain, but uh-huh. Dread D'Amato and the woman, the FBI agent who was her handler, were in a car. We come screeching up. I'm with a stuntman who does some crazy driving. I thought we were going to die. I jump out of the car in the rain, run into the back of their car, and I listen to something, and then I look really mad.
Yeah.
And I hand a photo over to the front, and I say, was this man with him? And she says, yes. And I look even madder, and I run out, and the car screeches off. And that was my Soprano.
Yeah.
And they said it was going to be a recurring character, but never was.
Oh,
I didn't look mad enough or something.
Does that happen often? Like they'll tell you have like a reoccurring role and then nothing?
I think what happens is, yes, but I think is they think it's going to be a recurring character, especially with recurring stuff. It's it can be hard to know where storylines are going to go. Like Blacklist, I was supposed to be on again for the second, for that next season, the Russian dude's attaché.
Yep.
But then they just didn't call. And I was like, and I think I had four episodes, and it was fun. I loved being on it.
I love that show. That's it. Because I was like the concierge of the under $20 market, so I identified a lot with Raymond.
That's great. That's
I was great. Like, I was the guy you need. You need this. You need to hide something. Yeah. You call me. You know.
Wow.
Yeah. So
you need to write a book.
I am.
Yes.
Oh, you are. You're like, I know.
I am. No, it's just crazy. I always just find myself in weird situations.
That's fascinating, man. And then you got to come up with a series of your own, or a movie or something.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. It's good. He's got some stories. I've read some of the manuscript already.
That's cool.
It's good. Yeah. All right. Let's see. What else was I going to ask you? Oh, okay. So House of Cards. I mean, you do really. Yeah. I forget the actor's name, but you guys really do look like brothers.
That's really funny.
Yes.
Michael Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a great dude. And I did all my scenes with him. I didn't act with anybody else.
Okay.
Except a buddy of mine actually, who came up. She played my wife, and there was one episode where she and I traveled together, and we saw her. That was fun. But yeah, I'm sure it helped me get the part. I didn't know what I was auditioning for. They had dummy scripts that approximated the same sort of emotionality that we had in the big scene of my first episode.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. He was my favorite character in the show. So mm-hmm. it was fun. And he's a great dude. He's a great guy. It just being on that show, it was even more, it helped even more, I think, before the episodes aired, because nobody knew if Stamper was alive.
Yeah.
They just knew that I was coming on IMDb. I was listed as Stamp. My last name was Stamper. So it was like a lot of mystery. I think some people thought maybe it was going to be, it was amazing the doors that opened and the people who said, so what are you doing in House of Cards? You're Stamper. Stamper's brother.
Yeah,
and nice. I'd be like, well, I can't say. And so I think maybe some people thought it was going to be like a huge role, like Corey Stoll in the first season or something. And I did not disabuse them of that thought.
Yeah, you know, Kelly, I gotta give you extra thanks, man, because there's some girl I've been trying to, you know, win her over for a while, and she loves House of Cards. Oh. And I told her you were coming on the podcast, and so I think that might, you know,
uh-huh.
help my chances a little bit. She was real excited. She's like, oh, no nice. Way, like, what?
Nice. What's her name?
What's her name?
Yeah, Elena. Oh, you might not want to say Elena.
Yeah, give her a shout out. Yeah,
he's a solid dude. Go for it, Elena.
Appreciate you, Kelly. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right, let's see what else. Okay, so being from Oregon, right, West Coast, how do you enjoy living in New York City?
Oh, I love it. I love Brooklyn. I love and I love Manhattan. I love it. I love going back too. I've been trying to. So my parents live in Portland, and that's sort of, that's basically where I'm from. And my aunt and other extended family lives in the mountains in Central Oregon near Bend, outside of Bend.
Yep.
And so it's great for us. It's like the best of both worlds. We go to LA to visit with, you know, to commune with my wife's past, and we go to Portland and Central Oregon for different versions of Oregon. It's great. We spent Christmas in right outside of Bend as well. It was beautiful, beautiful. And actually, I've been able to go back a ton this year because my dad, as I said, was in Congress, and he published a memoir called Catch and Release. It's actually a really good read. And he had a bit of a book tour around Oregon, and I came out, I think, four times to go to different places and hear him talk about it and see him sign the book and stuff. And he was supposed to come to New York on May 8th. And he was going to have a reading at the Strand bookstore. Do you know the Strand? Mm-hmm. Famous giant bookstore, one of the biggest in the world.
Yeah.
And I was going to interview him on stage, and he was going to talk about the book and do some readings, and, you know, everything's been canceled. So, but it's a great read. And it focuses on a time in politics in the 70s and 80s, when actually even enemies could work together. I don't know. It sounds like a foreign country, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Given today's environment.
Yeah.
So it's, if anyone's interested in if anyone's interested in politics, it's a pretty great read called Catch and Release.
Definitely. Right, cool. Cool. All right. One last question. I guess a personal question, Kelly, you know, cause you've been with your wife for a while, right? Like who you moved to New York with.
Yeah.
You guys obviously been together for a long time, and you were mentioned kind of like your guys' schedules sometimes don't align. How have you guys made it work this long? And then what are maybe some things you do as far as like making sure you guys do have time for each other?
I don't know if we have, I mean, I think we're, one of the things we do is every weekend, when she went to grad school and was only home on weekends, for instance, for a chunk of time. And, but if we're particularly busy, we find that time where we have the park, we have Prospect Park right near us, and walking around it is almost exactly an hour. So we, even if we're not in the mood, walk around the park because we talk, when we do that. And we varied it now, so we walk through the neighborhood or something, but, that has been huge. And it sounds sort of silly, but it's, just talking, finding out where you are, where you're at. Even if it's me talking most of the time or her talking most of the time on any given walk, it's just connection. And we, you know, we've rarely, she was actually at the scientist/teacher part of her. She was just in Romania and Greece this last summer, leading a group of students. And that was 5 weeks. That's the longest we've been apart. Solidly, like we can have days where we just see each other at night or just in the morning, but that was the longest we've been apart solidly for quite a while. I don't know. We don't have any tricks. Trying to make sure we talk is big, and removing ourselves from the familiar house apartment environment to do that is big. That's the thing. That's our go-to tweak.
Okay. All right, good stuff. Jay, anything else from you?
No, I'm just really, really very, very grateful that you came on our show. And I just wanted to say it's, you know, as a trader, I have no artistic talent whatsoever. So, you know, artists, actors, musicians, I have a great respect.
Absolutely.
For people who do that because they sort of elevate us and take us out of our daily sort of grind and, you know, put us into a different place. And, you take me back home. So that is a beautiful thing. And I thank you very much for that.
That is very kind of you and lovely stated.
Yeah.
If that's a word. No, that's really kind. But also, you know, back at you because you guys, I have so much respect. My wife has a math brain, you know, and her mother was back in the 40s was one of the first women working on computers back when that was like a punch cards and everything.
Really? Oh, so very cool.
I admire people who do what you do, who can think like you do. I don't even think I could improv my way out of a fake trade scene. So it's, you know, the admiration goes both ways.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Yeah. Thank you. So that concludes today's episode of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review it for us. If you guys are interested in learning Market Profile, if you're interested in joining a serious but fun community of traders, come join JJ and I at microefutures.com. Kelly, tell the listeners where they can find you and anything else you'd like them to know.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter, both at Kelly O'Coin, KellyAucoin 77, which is the year that my beloved Portland Trailblazers last won the championship. And also, I pretend it was the year I was born.
Yeah. There you go. Well, it's tough for me. I'm a Jets fan, Kelly, and they haven't done anything in my lifetime. So, yeah, whatever.
But you hang in there. True fan. Yeah.
You got to. You got to. But see, that's why I do like fantasy sports, because it actually gives me some interest. My team's always bad.
Yeah. It's all perspective.
Yeah. It's all perspective, right? All right. So for Kaiser Soza.
Oh, definitely.
He's Kumar. I'm Harold. Make sure you guys use stop, so.
Definitely. And unless you got a Wells notice with our name on it, we are definitely not uncertain.
All right. You guys have a good one.